KALW.
I just kind of stuck it up as far as I thought it should go. And she just kind of nodded and was like, yeah, that looks good. And I was like, okay.
COVID cases are on the rise in the Bay Area. More people are getting tested, and now there's a backlog.
The times that it takes to wait to get in to get a test has been increasing. And then the turnaround time, or the time from getting the test to getting your results, has also increased.
We'll hear why the testing experience varies from site to site and how the state plans to fix it. We'll also get an answer to your question about whether negative tests confirm you're actually safe from the disease. Then, an event designer from San Francisco travels the globe planning luxurious parties and affairs.
You know, if I look at an outfit, I'll know that that's Tom Ford. If you walk into an event, I want people to know that that's an Edward Ferrati.
And we want you to know. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. By now, over 4 months into the shelter in place, you've probably swapped COVID testing stories. Or maybe you've been on a Zoom call with questions like, how did you get an appointment? Did it hurt? And how long to get the results? I've definitely had those conversations. Experiences are all over the place. And to add to the confusion, Governor Gavin Newsom has announced new testing guidelines as cases continue to rise in California and labs are becoming backlogged. Some testing sites report waits as long as 14 days for results, which is exactly the amount of time you're supposed to quarantine. The new rules are intended to smooth that out and ensure the most vulnerable get tested first. KALW's health reporter Angela Johnston explains more.
My partner tested positive for COVID. Once I heard, I set up a testing appointment right away. So did our housemates, his coworkers, and a group of friends we saw from a distance at the park. Everyone booked a slot pretty quickly. But that's where our experiences diverged. I drove to UCSF, waited in line in my car, and braced myself for an uncomfortable swab. It was the nasopharyngeal type, meaning it went way up there, tickling my brain and making my eyes water. And I got the results so quickly, like within 6 hours. I was shocked and also relieved. It was negative. But then I talked to my friend Caro de Freitas, whose experience was totally different.
It was a very kind of cursory swab on the inside of, like a very shallow swab on the inside of both nostrils and move it, and we just moved along.
No uncomfortable nose test? Turns out this less invasive type of swab is actually common now. More recently, I heard another testing story from Chris Agusta, a producer here at KALW.
So the closest place for me to get a test was a CVS, and they had a drive-through, and the test was self-administered.
Meaning a nurse handed him a test kit and watched Chris do it.
She kind of like mimed how to do it and how far to put the swab up your nose and all of that. And I just kind of stuck it up as far as I thought it should go. And she just kind of nodded and was like, yeah, that looks good. And I was like, okay.
He still hasn't gotten his results back, by the way. It's been over a week and a half. Yes, Chris lives in a different county than me, but with all these different testing experiences, I wondered, is Chris's self-inflicted test as accurate as mine or my friend's, whose swab went only halfway up her nose?
The answer to that is that the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA and CDC, have said that multiple specimen types are acceptable. And that wasn't the case at the beginning of the pandemic. And really, things have evolved over time.
That's Dr. Susan Phillip, a deputy health officer with the San Francisco Department of Public Health, who says, we're learning as we go. It's the novel coronavirus, after all. She points to new research that shows all different types of swabs produce pretty much the same result. And not only is one at the surface of your nostril more comfortable, it's also easier to administer. You don't need a registered nurse to do it.
And also, those are FDA approved to be done by the patient themselves, by the person themselves, with a clinician watching.
While most sites are switching over to less invasive swabs, what type of test you get depends on where you go. So does the wait time for an appointment and results. There are many different organizations running the testing sites. In San Francisco, there's your doctor's office or an urgent care center. Then there's several free city-run sites. Some are operated by a company called Color. Not to mention state-sponsored sites run by different companies as well. You could even go to a CVS like Chris. But here's the big difference. If you get a test at a big hospital like UCSF, they send tests to their own labs, so chances are you'll get your results pretty quickly. But if you go to one of the city or state test sites right now, you'll run into some delays.
Across the country and across the state, and also unfortunately here in San Francisco, the time that it takes to wait to get in to get a test has been increasing. And then because of the very high numbers of tests that are being processed by all the laboratories, the turnaround time or the time from getting the test to getting your results has also increased.
Not great for containing the virus, because the longer you have to wait for your result, the more people you may infect. And cases in the Bay Area continue to rise, and cities have ramped up testing. But the spike is being felt all across the state. California saw 11,000 new cases on Monday, and according to the San Francisco Chronicle, the average number of daily cases in July has doubled compared to last month. So that's leading to more testing, and a lot of those tests are getting bottlenecked at these two big labs, Quest Diagnostics and LabCorp. And by the way, they just warned, wait until flu season. Keeping up with demand will be even more difficult.
So, there are some things that we can work on and try to improve, and some things that they're larger than just the city and county of San Francisco. They're statewide, they're nationwide.
So last week, the governor announced a set of non-mandatory testing guidelines with a tier system. The first group with the biggest priority is people in the hospital and people who have been in contact with people who have COVID-19. Then comes everyone else who has symptoms or those who live and work in congregate living facilities. Tier 3 is essential public-facing workers. And then there's the lowest rung, people who are asymptomatic but want to see if they have it or not. Anecdotally, I've heard of a lot of people doing this, getting a test to confirm they can go visit their parents or rent a cabin with another bubble of friends. Under these new guidelines, you shouldn't be able to get tested for this reason until the backlog is all sorted out and the state's testing turnaround time is less than 48 hours.
We have also added into the second tier really a piece to think about structural health inequality and the neighborhoods and the communities that have been most impacted by COVID and have always been most impacted by health challenges.
San Francisco just opened up a new testing center in Potrero Hill for that reason. Other Bay Area counties are making a similar move, adding underserved communities into the tier system. In San Mateo County, their city manager tells me they spend thousands of dollars every other day moving their one community site around so people from Pescadero to East Palo Alto can be close to a test. In Alameda County, half of the community sites are in Oakland. Here's Dr. Jocelyn Freeman Garrick, the head of Alameda County's COVID testing team.
We did intentionally put sites in our vulnerable communities where we were seeing higher numbers.
She's on board for shorter wait times, getting results back to people faster, and bringing sites to neighborhoods and workers that need them most. But Dr. Garrick says removing other barriers are just as important.
Are we giving them the information in a way that is relatable in their language or in layman's terms that they understand? And have we dispelled all the mistrusts about the test? We still have all these barriers that we have to navigate to make testing equitable.
For instance, state sites run by Verily require you to have a Gmail address to sign up for a spot. Other operators' signups are even more confusing. The testing site at SF City College requires you register through a company called LHI Care. It was so confusing and clunky that when I was looking for a testing site, I gave up on LHI after the first 10 minutes. All health officers I spoke to said they're working on coming up with more strategies to make it easier to get tested, like moving sites directly to hotspot areas, outside large apartment buildings, or nursing homes.
And they may not be able to hop up and walk over to a testing site. And how can we deploy individuals to bring testing to them?
There's also talk of doing something called pool testing and running, say, 10 swabs together on one test. If it comes back negative, the 10 are good to go. If it's positive, only then do you need to test individually. In the meantime, health officers say testing is only one part of the picture, and it doesn't make up for tried and true prevention methods, like wearing a mask and social distancing. In San Francisco, I'm Angela Johnston for Cross Currents.
Angela is KALW's health reporter. You can find more of her stories online at kalw.org. While we're talking about testing, we wanted to share a query we got through our Hey Area platform, where you listeners ask questions and we journalists find the answers. A listener asked, quote, "Can we count on negative test results? Can we safely interact with friends and family who've tested negative and been careful?" Unquote. Thanks for reaching out with that question. For the answer, we connected with our colleagues at City Visions, heard Mondays at 6 p.m. here on KALW. They've got a regular guest named Dr. Peter Chin Hong. He's an infectious disease specialist at UCSF School of Medicine. Here's how he answered.
It's super tough and confusing. So the test is really a snapshot in the arc of disease. So if someone was truly negative within a 14-day period of potential exposure, and they haven't had additional risk exposures, I would believe it, as long as the test wasn't done right after exposure. So you have to give time for the virus to kind of make more children and express itself in disease. Otherwise, you know, it may be too early. But done well, say 7 days after potential exposure, I believe it.
Thanks for that answer from Dr. Peter Chin Hong and City Visions. If you've got questions about COVID-19, please send them our way. Go to kalw.org/coronavirus. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hanna Baba. Years before he became a global event designer, Edward Parati was a theater kid in San Francisco trying to find himself. Being in theater showed him he had potential, and he loved bringing people together. Edward uses those gifts and his eye for design to plan exquisite gatherings around the world. Corporations, socialites, and celebrities like Ariana Grande and Nick Jonas have hired him for his lavish touch. KALW's Janae Darden spoke with Edward Parati about his creative spirit and path to self-acceptance.
I'm so happy to talk to you, Edward. I'm just so interested in you. You grew up in San Francisco. What kind of kid were you growing up?
So picture this little tiny guy, because I was definitely not, I hadn't quite grown into my 6'4" frame now. Blonde hair, blue eyes, with a little bit of an accent and a really heavy lisp. So I used to get beat up all the time. I would be made fun of all the time. And so I got introverted and found a local theater group and got into it and started falling in love with the idea that it was an hour and a half or 2 hours of not being me and getting into character and being able to be someone else, and just kind of fell in love with the whole production element and creating these environments that would resonate with people when they're hearing the words, which I truly believe is what led me to what I'm doing now, because it's pretty much the same thing.
And I understand your grandfather... I've read that your grandfather inspired you as an artist.
My grandfather inspired me in the kitchen. But no, I think in regards to the creativity, I would say my grandmother and my great aunt, my godmother, are the ones who made sure that my sister and I, when we were growing up, would go to restaurants. They would take us to the greenhouse, Lair's Greenhouse, way back in the day. They would take us to the Dutch Oven at the Westin St. Francis. They would take us to the Blue Fox. They would take us into City of Paris to go have coffee or tea. And they taught this whole of how dining and an experience and serving and etiquette. And then when I started getting into theater, they're the ones who encouraged me. They're the ones, and you know, back in the days when I wasn't quite sure who I was, they were the ones who didn't pass any judgments, right? That it was okay to put on a Broadway album at the house and not feel bad. If they had been around when I came out, that they would have been the first ones to support it.
They would be so proud of you today. How did you go from this kid in San Francisco, you know, in the theater, growing to embrace your full self, to a global event designer?
Well, first off, I had no idea there was even an industry. I was working, going to school, and I ended up getting a job with an online publishing company. down in the South Bay. And at a certain point, they had bought the competition in Cleveland. And so they got rid of everybody in the Bay Area. And I mean, at that point, I didn't know what to do. And I'm trying not to feel sorry for myself. And I'm talking to some friends about, you know, what the next step is. And a friend of mine was the director of catering at a local hotel. And she was like, you know, my catering manager just gave notice. Why don't you come in and talk and we could talk about it. And I'm like, what do I know about food and catering? She's like, I can teach you food. What I can't teach you is how to handle contracts and how to handle people. She goes, and you know how to do that. So I ended up working at this hotel as a catering manager for about a year and discovering that there's an entire hospitality events industry. I mean, like I said, who knew? You go to these parties, but you don't think that there's a world around it. And I ended up falling in love with it. Although I did realize back in my early 20s that I knew better at that point to ever get between a bride and her mother and a chef.
Uh-oh.
Which is why I left the hotel. I'm like, I'm not doing that again. Well, yeah, look what I'm doing now. But it just kind of opened this door. And I made a list of, okay, and talk to people. If I want to get to a certain point, what do I need to learn? You know, and that came to learning how trade shows work, learning how travel works, learning how associations work, learning how corporations work, learning all these different pieces. So over the course of 15, 16 years, I did different roles with different companies to learn those aspects of it so that my puzzle would be complete. So that when I did finally hit the ground and said, hello world, here I am, I could talk every talk. And at that point, then I was able to let the creative beast out of its cage, so to speak.
I saw pictures from the Great Wall of China. How did you end up getting that gig and what was it? I mean, the pictures are stunning.
So that was for a corporation and I had gotten permission to actually take them into the ancestral temple and do a dinner in the ancestral temple where the massive brass bells are. And they came in and they played the bells and they just, it was, like I said, there's something about certain locations that just spark magic in me. And China's one of them. I just, there is a soul and spirit to those buildings that just the color and the detail and just the beauty of it that you want to enhance and not hide.
So you get inspiration on sometimes the things around you.
Most of the time it's things around me. I mean, fashion inspires me a lot. I feel like what part of what I do is on that lines because I have a design aesthetic. You know, if I look at an outfit, I'll know that that's Tom Ford. If you walk into an event, I want people to know that that's an Edward Parati.
I know that your industry has been hit by, you know, COVID-19, like pretty much just about every industry. When this is all over and we can go back out again and party, what's the first thing you're going to do?
We're going to have to take a step back, which is actually a great exercise of this is a chance to redefine how people meet. I think it's actually kind of cool.
So you're up for the challenge. You're up for the challenge.
Hands down up for the challenge because there are things that we have been doing and doing to death. And, you know, why not? I mean, once again, stop looking at what things are and start looking at the possibilities.
That was global event designer Edward Parati speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. For a link to photos of Edward's glamorous work, visit our website, kalw.org. Now, before we go, let's listen to some new music from a local artist. This is Price, a bi-coastal duo with one member in Oakland. They released their debut record, Isley, earlier this year.
Spread love and tempo.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Christopher Agusa, Imran Ali Mullick, Truk Nguyen, Marissa Ortega-Welch, and Babette Thomas. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shireen Adel. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.